From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. It wasn't until he was halfway through his trip along the equator that Thurston Clark realized what he was really afraid of wasn't the heat, the insects, or the border guards, but the auto accidents. On today's Fresh Air, I speak with travel writer Thurston Clark about the extremes of landscape, climate, and human behavior he found in his odyssey around the middle of the Earth. Also today, David Ray reads and talks about poems he wrote in memory of his son Sam, who died in an accident at the age of 19. Rock historian Ed Ward profiles New Orleans rocker Lloyd Price, and book critic John Leonard reviews Parting the Waters, America in the King Years by Taylor Branch. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Many people think of the equator as nothing but a line on the globe. But to Thurston Clark, it was the longest but least visited, least appreciated natural feature on Earth, one waiting to be explored. Clark is a writer and an inveterate traveler. In 1984, he began a journey around the Earth's middle through South America, Africa, Asia, and the Pacific Islands. 6 months of travel was spread out over the course of 5 trips that spanned more than 2 years. Between trips, he returned home to New York to write up his notes. Before Thurston Clark even started his trip, he learned in the library that at the equator you find superlatives: the heaviest rat, the widest river, longest snake, highest volcanoes, biggest flower, and stinkiest fruit. There is a consistent absence of twilight and dawn. Nowhere is the sun so high in the sky at midday for so many days of the year. Over the course of his journey, Clark says he became a connoisseur of heat. He told me that in 1984 he knew it was time to travel.
I had just finished writing a novel, and I'd been in the same room for a long time. And I think I was eager to go anywhere outside of that room and outside of the house. Also, as it turned out, it was my last chance to travel, because shortly after I came back from Ecuador, my wife gave birth to twins, so I'm tied down for a while. But I did have this feeling that I think people get when they begin to be middle-aged, about that perhaps you have a last chance to finally do some great feat of travel, to go to the end of a road or the last island in the chain or the end of a river. And I was looking at a globe and trying to figure out what in the world was left that hadn't been done. And the first thing I noticed was that a lot of the great overland routes you simply can't do anymore because of wars and natural disasters. You can't go from England to India. You can't go Cape to Cairo anymore. So all of the great routes that I had read about as a boy were closed, and so I had to find something else.
Why was it the equator that you chose?
Well, it was just by chance. I was in a friend's apartment in New York on the most miserable February day, you can imagine. And he had this lovely antique globe, and I picked it up. I was still trying to figure out a route of some kind, and I gave it a big spin. And it was a globe that was constructed in 1898, so most of the countries were French blue or British red, and you spun it, and all you saw was red or blue, except for this very prominent checkered line in the middle of around the middle of the Earth, which was the equator, and that really stood out. And I held this globe up to this frosted window pane and saw the snow outside, and I thought to myself, that's when I first thought, well, this is my route.
I'm sure there were times you were sorry that you chose it.
Well, a lot of people told me I was going to be sorry before I even started. I heard again and again, why do you want to go to the equator? It's all going to be nothing but steaming jungle, and it's going to be full of snakes, and it's going to be unpleasant. And as soon as I'd done a little bit of reading and thinking about it, I saw that this was absolutely the opposite of what was going to happen, that there's tremendous variety along the equator, depending on the altitude. For example, in Ecuador, I was in a snowfield on the equator, which is where the equator runs across Cayambe Volcano. There are coral atolls in the Pacific, there's desert, there's high plateau in Kenya, and of course there's plenty of the jungle as well, but there was a great deal of variety.
You know, it's easy to think of the equator as being a belt around the middle of the Earth. Is there any way that the equator is marked when you're traveling across the middle of the Earth?
Oh, yes. You mean monuments and things?
Yeah,
signs,
right.
Monuments?
Signs, monuments, sure.
Oh, yes. In fact, part of the task I set myself was to try to get to every single point in the world where the equator is crossed by a road or a train line or even a major river. And I found a great number of monuments. And the interesting thing was that each one seemed to say something about the country in which they were in fact, reflect the country in which they were in. In Brazil, in Macapá, the energetic and enthusiastic governor of Macapá was building a soccer field on the equator. So the equator would run right down the center of the field, and one team would defend the northern hemisphere, and the other would defend the southern hemisphere. In Gabon, in Africa, which is the richest country in Africa, the equatorial monument is surrounded by shards of champagne bottles because people take champagne along on a picnic, much as you'd pack a thermos of tea in another country, and they shatter the champagne bottles. In Kenya, which has a terrible overpopulation problem now, the equatorial signs that mark the equator in the middle of the road are thronged with handicraft salesmen, and every week they tell me there are more and more and more men who have come there desperate to sell a few curios to the foreigners who stop and have their picture taken by these signs.
Are there disputes in any of the countries about which part of the ground the equator is actually located on?
Well, yes, I found two disputes. The principal one was in Bandaka, in the middle of Zaire. Bandaka was originally Stanley's Equatorville. It was founded by the explorer Stanley 100 years earlier. And the Belgians, who were the colonial power in the Congo until 25 years ago, had put a brass plaque in a rock marking where the equator crossed the Zaire River. This plaque was wrenched out of the rock by President Mobutu about 20 years ago at the same time when all of the colonialist statues were being tipped over and carted away and all of the vestiges of Belgium were being destroyed. The Africans, when I was there, said that this was not the actual equator, that was the colonialist equator, and that the Africans had the real equator, and they knew where it was. Well, nobody was particularly eager to tell me where it was, so I think it was more of a folk story than truth. In fact, I finally found out that the equator in Bandaka ran along exactly along the edge of a fence that goes around one of the satellite stations.
My guest is traveler and writer Thurston Clark. His new book, Equator, is about his travels around the middle of the Earth. You started your journey in Guyana.
Yes, in French Guyana.
Okay.
There are three, so
right.
Yes, I started in French Guyana.
Right, and this is on the northeast coast of South America. And just to set the scene here, the owner of the only hotel in French Guyana greeted you with this welcome. He said, "Welcome to the end of nowhere." Actually, it had a little kind of obscenity in there as well.
Yes.
Now, did it strike you that way, the end of nowhere?
French Guiana certainly did strike me that way. This was the only motel in French Guiana. This was a retired American sailor who had come there. It did strike me as the end of nowhere. First of all, French Guiana is the largest remaining European mainland colony anywhere in the world. It's a country with about 75,000 people, and it's about the size of Maine. And half of these people are grouped in the capital. So when you get outside of Cayenne, the capital, you find very, very few people. And those that are there are kind of people who've been swept from all four corners of the world, people who still want to live in a European colony. You find people from Indochina. You find Pieds-Noirs from Algeria. There are Dutch from Suriname who have come south after that country became independent. There are Haitians. There are a whole range of Europeans who've been kicked out of other colonial countries when they became independent. So you do have a feeling that you're there with a whole basket of scallywags. As far as being the end of nowhere, it has probably the least exploited and least explored jungle anywhere in the world. And a lot of it is protected from European exploration by the French government to protect the Indians.
There's a guy who you met there who described himself as the Johnny Carson of Guyana. And he did a radio show, and you said to him, well, why stay here? And he said, well, where else would I have such freedom to broadcast? And I was wondering if that was kind of typical of people who thought of themselves as being in the middle of nowhere, as being, you know, in a kind of hell on earth, but they thought that it was where they belonged for one reason or another.
Absolutely, absolutely. Everybody who I was talking to there, they all said that this is the great thing about French Guiana, is that we're completely independent, that nobody cares what we say or what we do. The Johnny Carson of French Guiana, in fact, was quite upset because he said I say the most awful things about this country and about things, and nobody cares. He said they listen to me, but nobody cares. I think I think that was certainly the case in French Guiana, that people were there for the independence, which is strange because at the same time you have a lot of French functionaries and a lot of bureaucratic kind of social welfare state imported from Paris. But when people get there, I think they slow down and stop caring about the rules.
The first morning you woke up in a French Guiana hotel, you opened up the door and a wasp the size of a sparrow flew in. And that was just the beginning of some of the fabulous insects that you were surrounded by night and day during your travels around the equator. How did you learn to tolerate that?
Well, I had traveled quite a bit in Africa, and insects were not my fear. I found that you never know until you get to these countries what you're afraid of. My first fear in these countries has always been being killed in a traffic accident, because you see the most awful accidents, and even though there are very, very few cars, French Guiana, for example, has a terrible rate of traffic accidents. They have one road, and the Dutch Creoles from Suriname are used to driving on one side and the French drive on the other. And so once they get across the border, they often have head-on collisions. That was a fear. I've never been particularly fond of snakes. And luckily, I only saw one snake in the wild. Although in French Guiana, I did stay at the motel. The man who owned the motel, his stepson was a snake fancier and had filled aquariums upstairs with poisonous snakes. I asked his mother, when she came, gave me a tour of these snakes, and I said, well, where does he find them, imagining them expeditions up remote rivers? And she said, Monsieur, he finds them everywhere, most of them within 100 yards of the hotel and at night. So after that, I used a flashlight at night when I was walking around that motel.
In your travels through Africa, you had some very unpredictable travel problems with visas and special permits that you needed. When you got to Gabon in Africa, a small country, you didn't have the right visa to write. And the Minister of Information told you that you would have to write each of approximately 50 other ministers and ask for their permission to write while you traveled. I mean, how are you supposed to know about these things before you get to a country?
Well, I did know about them, but what you're supposed to do if you're in my situation, which is traveling around on a tourist visa, is you're supposed to stay as far away as possible from anybody who works in the government. And I made the mistake, which I never repeated after that, of going and imagining that this man who worked for the Ministry of Tourism and Information was actually going to help me with a problem, and he'd been recommended to me. But you cannot, especially in Africa, go and announce yourself, particularly if you're on a tourist visa, as a writer. Otherwise, they want you have to get a whole bunch of permissions from the different government ministries. In fact, he cut the list down to 6 or 7, but I immediately got out of the capital as fast as I could. In fact, when I was I did a book 10 years earlier in Africa about the Tuareg in Niger, and I had to get a letter from the president himself saying that I could stay and interview people and research.
You write that if you want to see neocolonialism that torments Africans every day, stand near a roadblock. There were lots of roadblocks that you crossed during your passage through Africa. What were some of the reasons for the roadblocks?
Well, there are different official reasons given. They are to prevent the movement of people into the cities, to regulate that so the cities don't become overcrowded. They're to prevent smuggling. They are to check also the papers and insurance forms and things that the cars are supposed to have, to check people's identity papers, particularly where there's a fear of guerrillas, insurgency in the countryside. Of course, these are exactly the same reasons that the colonial powers had for instituting these roadblocks across Africa. And in many cases, the habit has just not died. It's a colonial habit. It's not an African habit. And it's been perpetuated by the African governments. Some roadblocks are kind of, the one in Gabon, kind of jolly affairs where everybody has a beer and talks and nothing too terrible happens. But in places like Uganda, people are murdered have been murdered at roadblocks. In other countries, a great deal, there's an extortion that takes place at these roadblocks.
Yeah, you make it sound like a lot of the roadblocks are really bribe opportunities.
Yes, they are.
In Uganda, you met teenage soldiers who, you know, demanded you give them something. One of the soldiers said, give me cigarettes, but you didn't smoke, so you couldn't give them any of that.
Yes, that was a particularly unpleasant roadblock because it was the exact same roadblock where several Europeans had been murdered within the last year. I didn't realize this until I was just about to get on the plane for Kampala. I thought that I would be avoiding some of the worst roadblocks by flying there. But I had been I didn't know that this was the airport at which the roadblock at which the Europeans had been killed until the last minute. So when I got there, I was quite reasonably fearful. But I assumed that I could just give him some money or something. And what he wanted was cigarettes. And the problem is I don't smoke. And I had I didn't have the presence of mind to say, well, have something else. I just kind of stammered that I didn't smoke. And then he banged the car, and he said, you must have something for me. And I reached into my pocket. Some of the other soldiers were picking up their guns and beginning to stagger over to the taxi. And I reached in and I found the buttons of the Great Equatorial Expedition. These were something I had made up to give to people along the way. I thought they'd be popular, but they were incredibly unpopular. People really wanted a little bit of money or a T-shirt or something. But I handed these out to the Ugandan soldiers, and they loved them. They pinned them on each other. They threw mock salutes. They laughed. They asked for buttons for their children. In fact, it's the only place in the equator where my buttons were at all popular. And then we drove on from there, and the taxi driver stopped, and he turned around, and he said, dear sir, you simply must stop at the next door and buy cigarettes for these soldiers, or we cannot go on. So that's precisely what we did.
Well, I want to talk with you more about some of your experiences and adventures traveling around the equator. But first, we're going to take a short break. My guest is writer Thurston Clark, and his new book, Equator, tells of his travels following the equator around the world. He traveled through Africa, Asia, South America, and the Pacific Islands on and off for almost 3 years. We'll take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest Thurston Clark is joining us from NPR member station KQED in San Francisco. You visited the Virunga Mountains where the mountain gorillas are. These are the same mountain gorillas that Dian Fossey worked to save. These are the mountain gorillas in the movie Gorillas in the Mist. I thought you had a very interesting reaction to the mountain gorillas. You saw the whole reserve as a kind of neo-colonial experience.
Yes, I did. Most of the visitors, in fact, practically all the visitors, were European, or Americans and Europeans, who paid a great deal of money to go there. There are very few gorilla watching slots available. There are kind of six people go at a time, maybe 18 or 20 people a day. And people pay a tremendous amount of money to do this. And I found that the people who lived in the fields right next to the gorillas, the same fields through which we were tramping with our safari gear into the mountains to see the gorillas, had never seen a mountain gorilla. In fact, some of them were unsure as to exactly what they looked like. They had seen the face in pictures and things, but they weren't sure what the whole body looked like. This is the case, of course, in a lot of the game parks, that Europeans are much more interested in the animals and wild animals than Africans.
So to some of the Africans, the gorillas seemed like they were there for the whites.
That's right. They said, two or three people said to me, they're for you, les blancs, and they would kind of hold out their hands as if they were a present to us. The people, the conservationists there, have done very good work, though, I should say, educating the farmers as to the importance of the gorilla habitat, the bamboo forest in which they live, as a water resource, because this forest kind of soaks up water like a sponge and then slowly releases it to the farmers' fields. So I think the farmers, from the surveys that have been done, they do understand the importance of the gorillas for their farms, and certainly the government officials in Rwanda understand the importance of the gorillas for foreign exchange, because they earn a tremendous amount of foreign exchange for Rwanda. But still, the Africans, the people who I talked to who lived right around it, had really no affection for the gorillas as such.
The equator is a place of extremes, extreme heat, virtually no sunrise or sunset. The sun rises and sets very suddenly. No twilight. Is it a place of extreme living conditions as well? Did you find that the people lived in extremes just as the climate expressed an extreme?
There was such variety. I mean, some countries, Sumatra, for example, was relatively well off, the people there. The people in Africa were a lot of the people I found on the equator in Africa were quite course, quite impoverished. One thing that I did find that united everyone was what I consider a certain heroism. Now, perhaps to explain this, I should say, when I was in Uganda, I gave a talk at Makerere University and to the English class. And the literature that they were analyzing was Alistair MacLean and Robert Ludlum, these paperback thrillers that had been cast off by expatriates. And afterwards, I was talking to one of the students, and I said, don't you have any other access to any other books? And he said, no, sir, we don't, and we know what this literature is. He said, but you see, this is the only time we're ever going to be students, and so we must deal with what we have because we want to make the most of our one and only precious lives. And I found that this is something that I found elsewhere. I found people struggling to make the most of their one and only precious lives. The man who realized finally in Kinshasa that he was going to have to smuggle ivory if he wanted to support his family. There were other cases. And I think this is, of course, something that we all try to do. And so I found this a constant around the equator. There were several other things that I found that were that you found almost everywhere you went. But
well, what was that? Because this was something of a theme trip, so I'm wondering what what themes emerged from it.
Well, there were some. One of the themes which we've already touched on was the overpopulation, which I found in Kenya and in the Pacific atolls. Another theme is I found the VCR was having a tremendous effect. The taped movies were really... I think it's somewhat, you know, 20 years ago, everybody said 25 years ago that radio coming to third world countries was creating great political changes. It was attracting people to the cities. And now, I found that in the smallest villages in Africa, in the smallest, most remote atolls in the Pacific, people were able to see three or four Hollywood movies a week because all you need is a TV set, a generator, and a library of pirated tapes. And so that suddenly people all over the world are seeing visual images of great wealth. And it's having a it's going to have, I think, a tremendous effect on their culture. It's going to pull more and more people out of the countryside into the cities looking for the things that they can now see, visualize. And so I think the VCR, and this I found everywhere along the equator, that people had just seen the VCR in the last 2 years.
Toward the end of your journey, you got real sick. You got stricken with some rare intestinal parasites that it took you a really long time to get rid of. You ate at a restaurant that served you bad seafood?
Yes. It was supposed to be one of the best restaurants in town, but it's always the case. I mean, I've been to India, and the only time I got sick in India was when I ate in one of those fabulous romantic hotels that they were always advertising for tourists, and I had been given a free meal courtesy of the tourist department there, and I was poisoned for days. I have no fear of eating on street stalls or eating in the most simple restaurants as long as the food is cooked. If you see them cook the food and you know they've cooked the food and it's well cooked, there's no problem. But if you go to some of these fancy restaurants, they bring something out of the kitchen. You don't know how long it's been sitting around. Actually, it turned out that my guide who took me up to Kayumbe Volcano, which is where the equator runs across that ice field, had eaten in the same restaurant the following night and so arrived looking absolutely like death and was one day further away from healing. And we kind of shared cups of tea and Lomatil on the drive up to the equator.
Did these parasites help end your journey?
No. What ended my journey slightly early was an earthquake, the earthquake in Ecuador, which happened. I was planning to go to Ecuador, I think it was the 4th or 5th of March several years ago, and take a bus down this road to Lago Agria down in the jungle. The road kind of parallels the equator. And at the last minute, I changed my mind because I realized it was the equinox was coming up and the sun would be absolutely overhead the equator. And so I would wait for 2 or 3 weeks to go to Ecuador. And I'm glad I did because on that exact night that I was planning to be taking a bus down into the jungle, there was the terrible earthquake. And a number of the buses were just entombed in feet of mud and everybody was killed. So I think that is in some ways the closest call I had. I mean, I had my ticket booked and everything was set. And I just at the last minute changed my mind.
Well,
and
now,
that did cut the trip short because I wasn't able. At the time, the roads were cut and there was no way to get down to the jungle part of Ecuador.
Do you do all these travels just to write books about them?
This was specifically a trip that I was going to write about. In 1970, after I finished graduate school in African and Middle Eastern studies. I took an enormous trip around Africa. I hitchhiked. I went by train. I went all the way down West Africa, down the coast of West Africa. I hitched down Southern Africa. I came up through East Africa and Ethiopia. I went all over the place, and that was simply for the joy of travel. I didn't write about that. Then I did write a book about the Tuareg nomads during the drought of 1975, and I did write a book about that, but that was something that I was determined to do whether or not anyone would publish it. That was something I'd wanted to do for many years.
So tell me, when you're traveling through the equator, do you use sunscreen?
I use a big, first of all, I have a big hat. I'm balding, so I have to have a really big hat to keep the sun off the top of my head. Mostly, I just put it on my nose. I'm lucky that I don't burn. I have this kind of skin that tans very easily, and so I just watch out for my nose. I think the problem is in these countries that they're so hot. If you cover yourself up with sunscreen, you're just miserable because you're perspiring. It's like wearing a suit of polyester clothes or something. I mean, it's not the thing to wear in these countries. The best solution is just to stay out of the sun as much as possible and wear a hat.
One other question about the parasites that you got.
Yes.
How long did it take you to get rid of them?
It took me over a year and lots of courses of antibiotics, but finally they have gone, I hope.
When you were going through that year of not being able to get rid of them,
mm-hmm.
were you having second thoughts about your trip?
No, I've never had second thoughts about the trip. I think... because I travel, as I think a lot of people do, as much for the experience itself and for enjoying the travel as, first of all, for the anticipation of travel, and second, for the memory. And I think that travel is a way in which we enrich and nourish our interior lives, that constantly I am walking around and seeing things that will remind me of episodes and people I met during the 6 months. And I find that it's enriched my interior life. You know, some people believe that that's one of the, of course, reasons that people read, for the same reason, to enrich their interior lives, to nourish these lives. And I think that this may be why travel writing and travel literature is so enduring and has become so popular and continues to be so popular, because it kind of stands at the intersection of these two methods of nourishing your interior life, travel and reading.
Let me point out that you said you love about travel the anticipation and the memory, but it always seems that the travel itself is so filled with hardship that's not very enjoyable in itself.
Physical hardship, yes, but I think that the people that I met, I think, more than make up for it. I think at the end of the book I said that I would always think of the equator as a necklace of people stretching around the world, and I found that those encounters certainly make up for it. You remember, as well, of course, you remember the few times that you were terribly ill, but in general, I found that I was no less uncomfortable than I would be at home. A lot of the days went by without great suffering. But, of course, you don't mention those in the book. I don't mention those in the book. It would be rather dull if I told everybody, well, today I felt fine. So maybe it comes across. I think that the few times I was sick or perhaps come across as more important than they were.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
My guest has been Thurston Clark, and his new book, Equator, is published by William Morrow. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with former NBC TV newsman Edwin Newman. Newman has also written 3 books on the English language. His latest, I Must Say, Edwin Newman on English, The News, and Other Matters, has just been published. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Poet David Ray's son died in an alcohol-related accident at the age of 19. Ray says he wrote poems about his son not out of choice, not for therapy, but out of compulsion. Coming up, David Ray reads these poems and talks about the mourning process. Also, rock historian Ed Ward profiles Lloyd Price, the New Orleans rocker best remembered for the hits Personality and Stagger Lee. And book critic John Leonard reviews Parting the Waters, America in the King Years by Taylor Branch. The book argues that the early 60s, until now identified as the Kennedy era, ought to be identified with Martin Luther King. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Brian Naylor. A victorious Brian Mulroney held a press conference this afternoon. The Canadian Prime Minister held his party's majority in the Canadian Parliament after national elections yesterday. Mulroney said his government's first priority would be to ratify the U.S.-Canada Free Trade Treaty. Richard Reynolds reports from Toronto.
It was often said that Canadians were doing more than voting for a new government in yesterday's election. They were voting on the future of the free trade treaty that Prime Minister Mulroney spent 3 years negotiating with the United States. Mulroney agreed this afternoon and claimed that Canadians had voted in favor of free trade.
We submitted the issue to the Canadian people. Somebody said, let the people decide. People have decided. We have a mandate to proceed, pursuant to all of the objective and honorable traditions that exist in Canada. And we would propose to do just that.
Mulroney said he will be recalling the Canadian Parliament as soon as December 12th to pass the legislation required to ratify the treaty. If he is successful, as seems likely, the treaty will take effect as scheduled on January the 1st. For National Public Radio, I'm Richard Reynolds in Toronto.
President-elect George Bush met with Mexico's president-elect today in Houston. Steve Hine from member station KUHF reports from the Johnson Space Center.
The informal meeting was the first time Bush met Carlos Salinas de Gortari. The two future presidents could have spent days discussing all the issues facing the U.S. and Mexico, but the 2 hours of meetings centered on trade, drugs, foreign debt, and immigration. Bush says the dialogue should continue.
I am absolutely confident after this initial visit that we are both committed to improving a bilateral relationship that is essential, in my view, as far as the United States of America is concerned.
Mexican President-elect de Gortari says the meeting met all his expectations. He invited Bush to meet again, next time in Mexico. For National Public Radio, I'm Steve Hine in Houston.
Earlier today, Bush met in Atlanta, in Alabama, with a group of Republican governors. The president-elect promised to name a team of administration negotiators to meet with congressional leaders as soon as he takes office to work out a plan for reducing the nation's record $155 billion budget deficit. The Reagan administration's latest and final economic forecast is far more optimistic than the predictions of most private economists. The White House said today it expects robust annual growth next year, with the gross national product rising at an annual rate of 3.5%. Most experts say inflation and higher interest rates will keep growth under 2.5%. The National Institutes of Health announced today that it will pay for AIDS research conducted by community hospitals, clinics, and even groups of private doctors. The move is welcomed by AIDS advocates who say it will make experimental drugs more available to patients and could speed research. NPR's Michael Scholar has more.
Government research on new AIDS treatments is now done at 34 major universities and research centers around the country. AIDS advocates and patients have long complained that this makes it tough for people who don't live near these centers to take part in the latest drug trials, and many patients don't want to leave their communities or their private doctors. The new government program will provide $6 million for local research projects, in essence, bringing research to the patients and their doctors. Now there are only two community research projects, in New York City and San Francisco, paid for with private funds. The government support should spur many more projects and help attract groups of AIDS patients like IV drug abusers and inner-city minorities that now rarely take part in AIDS trials. This is Michael Scholar in Washington.
Stock prices were higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Industrial Average rose more than 11 points to close at 2077.7. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Lloyd Price was one of the first black music entrepreneurs. In the 50s and 60s, he owned a nightclub and some record labels and was part owner of his own music publishing company. But what first got him started and what sustained him was his voice. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward has this profile of Lloyd Price.
New Orleans has an odd relationship to its musical heritage. It enshrines the past while ignoring the present, but even when it does that, it has a selective memory at best. The very cliquishness of the music scene there sees to that. Get on somebody's bad side and that's it. And one of the best ways to get on the bad side of the entire town is to move away and then make it big. So when the story of rock and roll in New Orleans is told in outline, one name that gets glossed over a lot is that of Lloyd Price. As you can hear from Tell Me Pretty Baby, with its classic Professor Longhair-style piano intro and its second-line drumming, Lloyd Price was firmly in the best traditions of New Orleans rock and roll, and, it should be said, probably the second performer, after Fats Domino, to have rock and roll hits out of the Crescent City. In fact, it was Fats' success that brought Art Rupe, owner of Specialty Records in L.A., to New Orleans looking for talent. He sent word out via the Okie Dokie radio show, a program aimed at black listeners, that he was looking for talent, and he auditioned one performer after another. "I felt I had failed," he told an interviewer much later. "They all sounded very amateurish and quite poor, and I feel funny when I tell you this, but it's true." The last one to audition was Lloyd Price, and he was just 17 years old. He was rehearsing and rehearsing, just chewing up the clock, so I finally said to him, "Look, kid, if you don't get yourself together, I'm splitting." The kid literally began to cry, so I said, "Okay, I'll listen to it." Good thing he did. Once Price had played his tune, Rupe canceled his trip back to California and got Dave Bartholomew, Fats Domino's producer, to put together a recording band immediately. Fats himself played the mighty piano intro, the record established the Specialty label in New Orleans, and was the top rhythm and blues record of 1952, selling well over a million copies. Claudie Miss Claudie was one of the first black rock and roll records to attract a sizable white following, and it looked like Lloyd Price was going to be a major attraction when out of nowhere Uncle Sam struck. Price was drafted and sent to the Far East for 2 years. By the time he got out of the Army in 1956, Rupe had discovered Little Richard in New Orleans, and he didn't need Price anymore. But Price, like many New Orleans rock and rollers right about then, decided that the city was a trap and headed to Washington, D.C. There he started his own record label and had another hit right off the bat.
Just because you left and said goodbye, do you think that I will sit and cry? Even if my heart should tell me so, darling, I would rather let you go.
Just Because was picked up by ABC Paramount, a major label looking to get into rock and roll, and served notice that Lloyd Price was back. And although he was no longer in New Orleans, the city served as his inspiration still, because for his biggest hit ever, he took an old song about a bad man, tacked on a haiku to open it, and hit the top of the pop charts in 1957 with Staggerly.
The night was clear, and the moon was yellow, and the leaves came tumbling down. I was standing on the corner when I heard my bulldog bark. He was barking.
was the last touch of New Orleans he had to offer. ABC Paramount moved him in a pop direction, and now that he was living in New York, it made sense. Buried under orchestras and backup singers, he was still very successful.
Over and over, I tried to prove my love to you. Over and over, what more can I do? Over and over, my friend says I'm a fool. But over, over and over, I'll be a fool for you. Cause you've got
personality,
walk
with personality,
talk
with personality,
smile
with personality,
charm.
Between 1952 and 1969, Lloyd Price charted nearly 20 records, owned a couple of record labels, one of which put out Wilson Pickett's first records, and was a very successful Manhattan nightclub owner. I have no idea what he's doing now, but he's only 54, and if he's made some decent investments, he's probably doing a lot better than most of the musicians he left behind in New Orleans.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll.
Goodbye, Cornell, darling. Down the road.
This is Fresh Air.
Years ago, poet David Ray's son, Sam, died at the age of 19 in an alcohol-related accident. During Ray's long period of grief, he's written many poems about his son, which are now collected in the new book, Sam's Book. It just received a poetry award from the Morris English Foundation in Philadelphia. The judge was poet Denise Levertov. She says, Ray has created a memorial to his son that transcends personal tragedy. Without anything so facile as resignation, he arrives at new depths of wisdom, resources which we must remember to remember in times of great need. We invited David Ray to read and talk about his poems. This poem is called Snapshots.
Had we known these few images were all we'd have of you, we'd have been taking pictures all the time. The one I need to forget, to stop weeping, to live, is the one in my mind without looking.
Was it choice or compulsion that made you start writing poems about your son after his death?
Absolutely compulsion. I had no choice. Writing really saved me at that point. It was one of the few things I had to hold on to. I had no choice at all.
How did writing save you?
It kept me, I had such an unbearable burden of feeling about this that it had to go somewhere. There was no place else to go. It was rage, it was sadness, it was tears. I had no place to go except my writing.
How did your son die?
My son was back for his sophomore year at Carleton College. He was a sophomore, and a group of his friends invited him downtown for drinks. They went down and got absolutely plastered. I don't know how they got so drunk, and my son didn't make it back to the dorm. He fell on his way home. He was the last to go back. Everything was bad about it. It was an absurd, thrown-away life. It was in the worst way. There was nothing about the circumstances of it that could be accepted. And my writing really was the only thing I could turn to.
Would you read your poem, How to Be Loved?
How to Be Loved, yes. That lake was where, beneath pine panels, Sam caught me reading How to Be Loved, a popular paperback, and asked me what it said. He never had that trouble. Main thing, I said, is never care. People will not love a man who cares, who shows he sadly needs that love. Insouciance is best. And Samuel Cyrus laughed, "Let's get this straight," he said. "You're reading a book called How to Be Loved that says the main thing is not to care, and you care enough to read it? I guess I love you anyhow." And he went on out to swim and fish and then install an old radio in my battered Plymouth Valiant. I hear them still, my radio, my son.
You know, I sometimes think that things like made-for-TV movies have made it really difficult for us to express sincere emotion without it feeling sentimental, because made-for-TV movies deal with, like, the death of children,
yes,
the death of parents all the time, and it's always very sentimentalized, very schmaltstop, and you wonder, how is it possible to express,
yes,
pure heartfelt emotion after all this sentimentality that we're surrounded,
well,
with?
Well, isn't that what Holden Caulfield was on about in The Catcher in the Rye? We're so surrounded with phoniness that the search for the authentic is probably half our lives. I mean, I get so I can't even pick up something printed on slick paper. There is such a phoniness around us. And I think that that goes together with a drug culture, including alcohol, numbing feeling. How can the authentic get through if feelings are numbed? Someone told me about a grieving person who was given a lot of tranquilizers and therefore did not even experience the ups and downs of grief. Now, I think that's a tragedy in itself. Faulkner said, "Between grief and nothing, I will take grief." That nothing is a terrible thing. At least you have a chance, if you go through that darkness, of emerging from it at some point.
You have a poem about mourning. It's called The Question. Would you read that?
Yes, that is particularly important right now to me because I have found it hard to give him up. And one does have to let go. And so this is the question. How long should I mourn? Let me ask you, my son, how long would you wish it? Do you want it to go on? Is there anything to be gained for either of us, for both of us? Are you so far away now that you're no more than a wish? The one I had on my mind before you fulfilled it came quite early one morning when mist was on fields and we had slept there waiting in a tent for you, yet rushed into the town as if a boy like you could not have appeared out of the fields, blue mist not far from the ocean. You see, my son's life meant so much to me, partly because I had a really wretched childhood and family life and all of that sort of thing, as my other writings deal with. And he was sort of my ace. I really thought he's going to have the good life. He's going to have the happy life that I didn't have. And then this happened. And he was an incredibly happy and well-rounded and gifted person. He was a straight-A student, athletic, and joyous. And I do think that in those 19 years, he did have a happy life, and that means a great deal to me. But I think that this, it's a bomb to anyone, but it was very much a bomb to me because I had so identified with his quest being mine. And one of the things that happens, as I say here in a couple of other poems, is that with a death like this, your roles are reversed. Suddenly, he's the father and I'm the son. I'm trying to learn from him the lessons that I wanted to teach him. And if they're real lessons, if they're really important, then I really have to hear them. I have to say, you wouldn't want my life to be destroyed, you know, because I wouldn't want yours to be destroyed. But it's that terrible reversal of roles.
How have you dealt with that question of when to stop mourning, and would your son really want you to keep mourning?
Well, I'm dealing with it. I'm trying to get through that and not to cling and not to hold on. But it's very difficult. Someone said, when you lose your parents, you lose your past, and when you lose a child, you lose your future. And there's a great deal to that. You know, there's an old Zen saying, what is the secret of happiness? Someone asked the guru, and the guru said, that's very simple. Grandfather die, father die, son die. And he said, that doesn't sound very happy. And the guru said, would you have it in any other way? And that's the truth of it.
You were telling me before that this book of poems for your late son Sam has gotten a stronger response from people than any other book of poems that you've had published, and that to you that was somehow like getting a medal for being in a concentration camp.
Yes, I did feel that ironic response to the Morris English Award. I was very grateful, but it was indeed painful in a sense. The survivor's guilt, you know, is a terrible problem. And so how could something good come out of something so horrible and unacceptable? And that's simply something one has to live with.
One more poem I'm going to ask you to read, and that is Brief Song.
Yes. There will come a day when you would have lived your life all the way through, mine long gone, and peace will descend then, such a great peace, like a breath moving those pines, moving even the stone. And then I can let go.
Thank you very much for reading some of your poems for us.
Thank you, Terry, for sharing.
Sam's book by David Ray is published by Wesleyan University Press. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered and check in with co-host Robert Siegel. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
How are you marking the 25th anniversary of the assassination of John F. Kennedy?
Well, we'll have a special report in the program tonight that actually was aired a few years ago on All Things Considered. It's called The Last Good Year, and it's some people's very personal recollections of the mood in the country 25 years ago and how that was broken by the death of President Kennedy.
What else are you covering today?
Well, today a lot of news of America and her neighbors, George Bush meeting with the Mexican president, and meanwhile news of the results of the Canadian election in which the Conservatives won. And of course, that means the U.S.-Canada Free Trade Pact is going to be approved.
Thanks, Robert. That and more is coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Parting the Waters, America in the King Years, is a new book by Taylor Branch that examines the early years of the civil rights movement at close range. Much has been written and said about the people who shaped this era, but book critic John Leonard says Parting the Waters breaks new ground.
Parting the Waters, which is 1,000 pages long, is only the first half of Taylor Branch's biography, history, and meditation on Martin Luther King Jr., the civil rights movement, and democracy in the years of Dwight Eisenhower, John Kennedy, and Lyndon Johnson. A second volume of equal heft, Pillar of Fire, will follow before most of us are done absorbing all there is to learn from this one. Together they'll add up to an encyclopedia of American race relations, as complex, persuasive, and gracefully written as anything in our literature. I've read David Garrow's Bearing the Cross, Mary King's Freedom Song, and Stephen B. Oates's Let the Trumpet Sound. I've watched all those wonderful hours of Eyes on the Prize on public television. I even served for a while myself as a foot soldier in Dr. King's mass movement of nonviolent civil disobedience. And yet I learned something new on almost every page of Taylor Branch, about the black church and the small black colleges, about Birmingham, Old Miss, and Atlanta, about the trouble-causing propensities of Adam Clayton Powell and the troublemaking sex life of Bayard Rustin, and the almost mystical courage and loneliness of Bob Moses in Mississippi in the Seasons of Blood, about Bobby Kennedy's Justice Department and J. Edgar Hoover's FBI, about Reinhold Niebuhr, Paul Tillich, and Mahatma Gandhi. Did you know, for instance, that blacks voted 60% to 40 for Eisenhower over Stevenson in 1956 and 70% to 30 for Kennedy over Nixon in 1960, after the Kennedy brothers intervened to get Dr. King out of a Georgia jail? Remember how close 1960 was? Parting the Waters also makes it crystal clear that J. Edgar Hoover, with his dirt on White House playgirls like Judith Campbell Exner, blackmailed the Kennedy administration into wiretapping Dr. King, and then sought to blackmail Dr. King with his own sex life, all in the service of the demented notion that Dr. King could be a Soviet tool because he talked on the telephone to a man named Stanley Levison, who might once upon a time have been a sympathizer with the American Communist Party. Branch, who wrote for Esquire, Harper's, and the Washington Monthly before he disappeared into the archives, seems to have ransacked every library, memorized every document, listened to every wiretap and tape recording, studied every photograph and film, and interviewed everybody alive and many I thought were dead. He's contentious, but not without pointing us in those directions where he's already gone and returned, so we can check him out. He's partisan, but not without filling us so full of information that we can argue back on the basis of facts we didn't know before he told us. He seeks to connect the evolution and the witness and the sacrifice of Dr. King to freedom movements everywhere. And yet he doesn't for an instant neglect the grubby details of infighting among Baptists or SNCC firebrands, nor the nightly tactical improvisations of voter registrations and lunch counter sit-ins, of bus boycotts and trailways freedom rides. Parting the Waters pays attention to the movement's various warts, but Dr. King, all 5 feet 6.5 inches of him, ends up looking at least as tall as Abraham Lincoln. In the same bloody way, we cut them both down to size.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine and is a columnist for New York Newsday and media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Parting the Waters by Taylor Branch. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, I speak with Patrick McGrath. He's been described as a Poe for the 80s, a postmodern gothic storyteller. Horror writing is a genre that comes easily to McGrath, who grew up on the grounds of an English asylum for the criminally insane. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new recording of compositions by Lou Harrison. Harrison studied with Henry Cowell at the same time John Cage did. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg discusses how we use dictionaries. He says there's a great deal more to dictionaries than looking up the meaning of words we don't know. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Amy Salad, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty, Lisa Bruton, and Deborah Beagle. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Burgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.